This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Some discoveries are intentional, others accidental. The latter was the case in dozens of stone spear points that were recently discovered in Stanley County near Charlotte. A man was planting a bush in his backyard when he unearthed Native American artifacts dating back more than 5,000 years. Today, Chris Thomas speaks with East Carolina University Professor of Archaeology, Dr. Randy Daniel, about the rare find.
Around the time the pyramids of Giza were finished, Stonehenge was consecrated, and bronze was the next big thing in Europe and Asia. Nomads living on the Western Hemisphere, about 300 miles west of the Atlantic Ocean, made stone points and buried them in the ground, probably for later use. 5,000 to 6,000 years later, in what's now known as New London, North Carolina, near the Stanley and Montgomery County line, those points were rediscovered in Leonard and Karen Sheeler's backyard. Dr. Daniel describes what it's like to hold something older than the Parthenon in the palm of his hand.
When I touch something that is that old, I know why I'm an archaeologist. It's a tangible reminder of a past way of life that I'm intensely curious about.
And could you walk me through the timeline of the excavation, when you guys arrived, when
Sure.
the dig started, and when you made some of the big discoveries, and I guess the reward, the payoff?
Leonard Sheeler discovered this cache of points in early 2014. He contacted me in the spring of that year. After my conversation with him and looking at the collection, I thought that perhaps it warranted some further digging, ultimately in his backyard. He kindly agreed to that. I didn't return there until the following fall with three graduate students from ECU. We spent a weekend re-excavating the area.
And about how many did you find, and what did you learn from them?
Ultimately, 81 points were recovered from this small hole, about 2 feet in diameter, about a foot and a half below the surface. We had several questions we were interested in asking of the artifacts. One, what were they typologically? What were their age? That question, we concluded they were unfinished spear points that date to about 5,000 or 6,000 years in age. It appears that this was an isolated cache. That is, it was not associated with any other habitation. The source of the stone appears to be from across the river from a prehistoric quarry there in Morro Mountain State Park, about 5 miles as the bird flies due south of the location where the points were recovered.
And when you were able to narrow it down to about 5,000, 6,000 years old, I imagine that must have been exciting. And when you put it in its proper context, I mean, how close is that to what we believe to be the beginning of human life, people living in what's now called North Carolina?
We know that humans have been in North Carolina a little over 13,000 years. That's consistent with some of the earliest occupations elsewhere in North America, although in some places the early occupations may predate that by a few millennia. So these 6,000 years is fairly old, but keep in mind that people have been in North Carolina at least twice as long as that.
And what do you look for when you are dating artifacts like that?
There's several ways to date archaeological remains. There are, for example, chemical physical techniques such as radiocarbon dating, but that requires organic materials, for example, wood, bone, or shell. So the stone itself can't really be dated archaeologically. So oftentimes archaeologists rely on the association of an artifact with some organic material, for example, charcoal from a fire pit. In this case, we had nothing like that to be able to associate with the tools. So we had to rely solely on their size and shape, their form, that we could relate to other known points, other known types that have been dated securely in other contexts. So in this case, we dated these points typologically rather than, say, using an absolute dating technique like radiocarbon dating.
When you have been talking to people about this most recent discovery, what's some of the reactions you get from people?
Probably the most common reaction is the age, 6,000 years old. It's hard for people to kind of comprehend that great antiquity. You know, it's hard to place that in context. Most people, in fact, are just amazed that we could find something that was that old and that people had been in North Carolina at least 6,000 years.
What kind of impact do you hope this discovery has not only on your community as archaeologists, but on North Carolinians as a whole, as I suppose they learn a little bit more about their past?
I hope the impact of this project would be twofold. One, it would alert people to the past that may literally be in their own backyard, as in the case with this find. And then at a second level, to alert my colleagues in the professional community about a little studied archaeological phenomenon of artifact caching.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Every third Saturday of June, the National Hollerin' Contest takes place in Spivey's Corner, North Carolina, in Sampson County. But this past Saturday's competition is probably the last time hoots and hollers are heard in this crossroads community. Organizers say the annual event has been suspended because of increasing cost and decreasing participation. But I was there in 2010 when the Hollerin' Contest was well attended. And in this feature, we look back at the nearly 50-year-old tradition. Over 2,000 people from across the state and country ventured to the small town of Spivey's Corner, northeast of Fayetteville, to hear the yodels and bellows of participants in the 42nd annual National Hollerin' Contest. It was hotter than a billy goat in a pepper patch, as they say. Many attendees came prepared with their sombrellas and hats to camp out in the shadeless open field behind the Spivey's Corner Fire Department. The hootin' and hollerin' may seem strange by today's standards, but before telephones and email, yelling was a common form of communication. In eastern North Carolina, as with many farming communities decades ago, farmers would shout across fields to their neighbors in the morning to let them know all was well. Kevin Jasper is a 4-time national hollerin' champion.
People all over the world will holler out and call their hogs and dogs and all that kind of thing. And generally they use a high pitch holler. I mean, just like you hear the typical pig call or hog call is soo-wee. And so the high intensity carries further, so you have a better chance of communicating to someone at a distance. And so that type of communication ended up turning into something that they used to do just for fun.
To celebrate the almost lost folk art of yelling, the first National Hollerin' Contest was held in the Summer of Love, 1969. Hollerin' Contest coordinator Wayne Edwards never imagined the annual competition would grow so big.
Started on a morning talk show at an AM radio station. Two men sitting around a microphone, just like we're doing right now, and talking about the old days. And they got to talking about the hollering and said, let's have a hollering contest. So it all got started back in 1969.
The very first contest flooded the town with participants and observers that competed in a variety of contests, such as biggest bell pepper contest, a watermelon roll, and a square dancing jamboree. This year, a total of 27 contestants competed for winning titles in the men's hollering contest.
Woo-hoo!
Ladies calling.
Woo-hoo!
Conch shell blowing. Whistling, and junior and teen hollering.
I have three older brothers, and they're pigs, and this is how I call them. Sue-wee! Sue-wee!
Some participants shared a story, others just approached the microphone and went for it. The hollering contest is a multi-generational event. Following in his grandfather's footsteps, Brandon Honeycutt from Godwin, North Carolina, was competing against four others in the junior hollering category.
Most of the hollers I know were things I picked up from working with my papa on his farm and things like that, because we'd always go out and we'd check his cows and we'd work in the field, and it's just things I picked up from that.
Honeycutt has been hollering since he was 5 years old and has competed in the contest before.
I didn't do too good. I got up on stage, and since I was little, I was real nervous, so I kind of blanked out and had to run off stage and ask my mama something, see what I'd forgotten, but I didn't do too bad.
This time, Honeycutt confidently took the stage and began his routine.
My mama and my papa would talk about how good of a cook their mama was and how she could always cook something good, and if they were ever out working, they always wanted it. And so if they were ever out in the field or outside playing and they heard anybody say, "Dinner! Dinner! Come get your dinner! Woo!" they would come a-running because they were not going to miss her good old-time food.
After all the team contestants performed, there was a brief pause while the judges' votes were tallied.
And your 2010 champion for the teen hollering contest from Godwin, North Carolina, contestant 402, Brandon Honeycutt.
Next was the ladies' hollering contest. The competition was fierce and serious, but Sheila Fry, a four-time winner of the contest, came out on top. In the men's contest, several former champions competed. Last year's national winner, Kevin Jasper from Moxville, North Carolina, explained his technique during the four-minute allotted time period.
But instead of yodeling, like our yodeler goes, yodel, 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 but a hollerer goes, oh, 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 and so it doesn't use the tongue kind of thing. And I'm going to do a part of Mr. Floyd Lee's old-timey holler. Oh, 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 oh.
While on stage, Jasper demonstrated a most difficult technique he calls the ditty.
It's where you make a sound when you inhale as well as when you exhale. And I'm convinced, I say this almost every year, I'm convinced that the respiratory therapist could use this holler in order to help their patients breathe better.
The winner of the National Hollering Contest is granted bragging rights and opportunities to perform at events and on television shows. But as participation dwindles and costs increase, this tradition is coming to an end. Organizers say they may have one final contest on what would be the 50th anniversary of the event. If you've ever wanted to know what goes on behind the scenes at Tryon Palace, here's your opportunity to take a tour. The next event takes place June 28th and will include a visit to the costume shop, discussion on historical clothing research, sewing techniques used in the past, and a tour of the historic Jones House. Today, Mac McKee speaks with marketing and communications manager Craig Ramey.
Tryon Palace has always been known for presenting living history in a beautiful manner. Now, in June, the palace will open up both its costume shop and conservation lab to the public. How do you retain that sense of mystery while at the same time remaining true to your educational goals by letting palace visitors peek behind the curtain, so to speak?
Well, really one of our biggest parts of our educational mission is letting people learn about the palace and its history. And to really get into that history, you need to know how we got there. And that's really behind the scenes from the start. So it's really a matter of perspective. But in the present day sense, I think people are naturally voyeuristic, and we're here in the 21st century where everybody can share everything electronically. They're used to being able to have that behind-the-scenes perspective and be able to look and learn more about things. So it's natural to us to want to open it up. And not only do we open up the costume shop and our gardens and the conservation lab to let people see what we have, but it's also another opportunity for us to show people what it takes to actually tell our story and let people know what history is about. So for us, we really think it enhances our educational mission more than anything.
Leslie Lambrecht, she will be conducting the costume shop tour. What are some of the tour highlights there?
The costume shop tour takes place in the Jones House, which is our costume shop. So people can go in there, and first of all, they're in a historic home, so they get to learn a little bit about that building, but they also get to see what it takes to put some of the costumes together. You know, going back to what I was talking about before, about people learning how the pieces come together, they often get to see how beautiful our costuming looks at the palace, but rarely do they get to see what brings it together. So people can go in there and they can see what parts are actually stitched together, or the forms that they use to put the costuming on and the process that they have to go through. You know, a lot of times people don't realize that, for example, during Candlelight, our Christmas event, which is one of our most popular events of the year, some of those dresses may take 60, 70 hours to put together.
When visitors think of Tryon Palace, the big time period that comes to mind is the mid-18th century. But you've had other programs recently that featured other time periods. And now, what other types of costumes can be required from time to time?
Well, in our costume shop, we specifically do focus on the 18th century, 19th century. We'll get a little bit into the Civil War as well. But for us, primarily, we do focus on the period that people would most likely associate with us, which is the 18th and 19th century.
Tell us about the conservation lab and Richard Baker's background in preserving all the antiques that fill Tryon Palace.
Right. So if you think about when you go to the palace, all the pieces that you see, whether it's a teapot or a painting or a piece of furniture, somebody has to make sure that those pieces are there for other people to enjoy forever. So Richard is really great at going around making sure that all these pieces are being taken care of. And it's very meticulous, very specific, and he opens up the lab to let people come in and see that work. He's so great at what he does. And lots of people have some of these items at their own homes that they are curious about how to take care of. And so often he'll get people going on his tour that are asking how they can polish silver or take care of their own paintings and things like that.
Have a lot of people been sharing tips with what Richard's information has been giving them to?
Sure. And I think it's a conversation that goes both ways. And that's really one of the best parts of the behind-the-scenes tours is, you know, whether you're in the lab or the gardens or the costume shop, it's an opportunity for you to step out of the normal tour and actually have a conversation with the experts that we have on staff and ask those questions that you might not be able to ask at any other time. So we're all learning from each other, and we all have something to take away from it.
And what do you hope that visitors will take from these visits to Tryon Palace during these behind-the-scenes tours?
Well, a couple of things. I think, number one, we want them to be as excited about history as we are. We want them to see the work that we put into it because we care about it. And we hope that once they see the work that we put into it, maybe they'll have a different appreciation for what we do, or at the very least, a greater appreciation for what we do, so that they'll be just as excited about our mission and history as we are.
These are ticketed events. How much are the tickets?
So the tickets are $6 if you want to do them just the tour by itself, or you can come and get a one-day pass, which is $20, and include that with your ticket.
If you need more information on this, please check out the Public Radio East events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Greg, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jared Brumbach, here to remind you that the program you're listening to right now is made possible by member support. Thank you if you've already given to Public Radio East in 2016, but know that if you have not, we still need your help. We are under a tight deadline of less than 2 weeks to close out our fiscal year on goal. What does that mean for you? Your action now can help us close our funding gap, ensuring more of the programming you're enjoying right now. Send your tax-deductible pledge and any amount to PRE Public Radio East, 800 College Court, New Bern, North Carolina, 28562. Or pledge online at our secure website, publicradioeast.org. Membership is Public Radio East's single largest source of funding. Thank you, members.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Early summer is a great time to be in the yard and garden. The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and it's the season that you're most likely to see baby wild animals outside. When we find a baby animal, it's tempting to try to help the little one. Unfortunately, this can sometimes cause more harm than good. This issue was tragically brought to light recently when two tourists in Yellowstone gathered up a bison calf and carried it to the ranger station when they thought the calf was cold. Rangers tried to reunite the calf with its herd, but it was rejected. After several attempts at reintroduction, the calf was euthanized. This story has received a lot of attention on social media and is worth sharing, if only to help other people learn not to make similar mistakes. Baby wild animals may seem helpless or vulnerable, but unless the animal is truly orphaned or injured, there is no need to intervene. For many species, the young are left unattended for much of the day. This is the case with baby deer and rabbits. A mother deer will bed her fawn down and leave it alone during the day. She will stay nearby and slip back in to feed her baby a couple of times throughout the course of the day. She won't show herself as long as you're nearby. She'll just stay quiet and watch. So if you find a baby deer on its own, leave it where it is and let mom come back and take care of it. The only time you need to be concerned is if the fawn is lying flat on his side or wandering and crying incessantly. In those cases, it may need help. Rabbit mothers take a similar approach. They carefully build their babies a nest, which they will return to several times each day. In between feedings, the nest and the combined body heat of the litter of bunnies serves to keep the babies warm. If the babies are small and the nest has been disturbed, you can lightly cover it with the natural materials that you find around the nest, like grass, fur, or leaves. You'll want to avoid touching the babies. It's not uncommon to see tiny bunnies out and moving around. If a bunny is about 4 inches long, has upright ears, and hops well, despite his diminutive size, he's independent from his mother and should be allowed to fend for himself. Baby birds are probably the most frequently encountered wildlife in the garden. Many birds that we see on the ground are fledglings. These are birds with fully feathered bodies, but short or non-existent tail feathers. These are adolescent birds who've left the nest. They may hop around, vocalize, and try unsuccessfully to fly. This is a normal part of their development. Baby birds actually learn to fly from the ground. When they leave the nest, they will spend 3 to 4 days, sometimes up to a week, on the ground, trying out their wings. The parents will stay nearby, feeding and protecting the fledgling. If you find a fledgling, contain all of your pets and allow the parents to tend to their baby during this awkward phase of its development. If you find a nearly or mostly featherless baby bird out of the nest, this is a different story. These little guys need help being returned to their original nest if possible. So enjoy watching the wildlife while you're out in the garden. Most of the time, these babies don't need our help. But in the rare event that you find one that does, you'll know just what to do.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.